The temple frescoes of Al-Khali are famous far and wide, said Kanina, as they walked through the crowds of children who kept trying to sell Rincewind things and introduce him to nice relatives.
Well, I can see they would be, Rincewind agreed.
Look, push off, will you? No, I don't want to buy whatever it is. No, I don't want to meet her or him either. Or it, you nasty little boy. Get off, will you? The last scream was to the group of children riding sedately on the luggage, which was plodding along patiently behind Rincewind and making no attempt to shake them off. Perhaps it was sickening for something, he thought, and brightened up a bit. How many people are there on this continent, do you think? He said.
I don't know, said Kanina, without turning round. Millions, I expect.
If I were wise, I wouldn't be here, said Rincewind, with feeling. They had been in Al-Khali, gateway to the whole mysterious continent of Klatch, for several hours. He was beginning to suffer. A decent city should have a bit of a fog about it, he considered, and people should live indoors, not spend all their time out on the streets. There shouldn't be all this sand and heat. And as for the wind... Ankh-Morpork had its famous smell, so full of personality that it could reduce a strong man to tears. But Al-Khali had its wind, blowing from the vastness of the deserts and continents nearer the rim. It was a gentle breeze, but it didn't stop, and eventually it had the same effect on visitors that a cheese grater achieves on a tomato. After a while, it seemed to have worn away your skin and was rasping directly across the nerves. To Kanina's sensitive nostrils, it carried aromatic messages from the heart of the continent, compounded of the chill of the deserts, the stink of the lions, the compost of the jungles, and the flatulence of wildebeest. Rincewind, of course, couldn't smell any of this. Adaptation is a wonderful thing, and most Morporkians would be hard put to smell a burning feather mattress at 5 feet.
"Where to next?" he said. "Somewhere out of the wind?"
"My father spent some time in Khali when he was hunting for the lost city of E," said Kanina, "and I seem to remember he spoke very highly of the Soak. It's a kind of bazaar."
"I suppose we just go and look for the second-hand hat stalls," said Rincewind, "because the whole idea is totally..."
"What I was hoping was that maybe we could be attacked. That seems the most sensible idea. My father said that very few strangers who entered the Soak ever came out again. Some very murderous types hang around there," he said. Rincewind gave this due consideration.
"Just run that by me again, will you?" he said.
"After you said we should be attacked, I seemed to hear a ringing in my ears."
"Well, we want to meet the criminal element, don't we?"
"Not exactly want," said Rincewind. "That wasn't the phrase I would have chosen." "How would you put it, then?"
"I think the phrase, not want, sums it up pretty well."
"But you agreed that we should get the hat."
"But not die in the process," said Rincewind, wretchedly. "That won't do anyone any good. Not me, anyway."
"My father always said that death is but a sleep," said Kanina.
"Yes, the hat told me that," said Rincewind, as they turned down a narrow, crowded street between the white adobe walls. "But the way I see it, it's a lot harder to get up in the morning."
"Look," said Kanina, "there's not much risk. You're with me."
"Yes, and you're looking forward to it, aren't you?" said Rincewind accusingly, as Kanina piloted them along a shady alley, with their retinue of pubescent entrepreneurs at their heels. "It's the old hereditary at work."
"Just shut up and try to look like a victim, will you?"
"I can do that all right," said Rincewind, beating off a particularly stubborn member of the Junior Chamber of Commerce. "I've had a lot of practice. For the last time, I don't want to buy anyone, you wretched child." He looked gloomily at the walls around them. At least there weren't any of those disturbing pictures here, but the hot breeze still blew the dust around him, and he was sick and tired of looking at sand. What he wanted was a couple of cool beers, a cold bath, and a change of clothing. It probably wouldn't make him feel better, but it would at least make feeling awful more enjoyable. Not that there was any beer here, probably. It was a funny thing, but in chilly cities like Ankh-Morpork, the big drink was beer, which cooled you down, but in places like this, where the whole sky was an oven with the door left open, people drank tiny little sticky drinks which set fire to the back of your throat. And the architecture was all wrong, and they had statues in their temples that, well, just weren't suitable. This wasn't the right kind of place for wizards. Of course, they had some local-grown alternative enchanters or some such, but not what you'd call decent magic. Kanina strolled ahead of him, humming to herself.
"You rather like her, don't you? I can tell," said a voice in his head.
"Oh, blast," thought Rincewind. "You're not my conscience again, are you?" your libido. It's a bit stuffy in here, isn't it? You haven't had it done up since the last time I was around. Look, go away, will you? I'm a wizard. Wizards are ruled by their heads, not by their hearts. And I'm getting votes from your glands, and they're telling me that as far as your body is concerned, your brain is in a minority of one. Yes, but it's got the casting vote then. Ha! That's what you think. Your heart has got nothing to do with this, by the way. It's merely a muscular organ which powers the circulation of the blood. But look at it like this. You quite like her, don't you? Well, Rincewind hesitated. Yes, he thought. She's pretty good company, eh? Nice voice. Well, of course. You'd like to see more of her. Well, Rincewind realized, with some surprise, that yes, he would. It wasn't that he was entirely unused to the company of women, but it always seemed to cause trouble, and of course it was a well-known fact that it was bad for the magical abilities, although he had to admit that his particular magical abilities, being approximately those of a rubber hammer, were shaky enough to start with. Then you've got nothing to lose, have you? His libido put in an oily tone of thought. It was at this point Rincewind realized that something important was missing. It took him a little while to realize what it was. No one had tried to sell him anything for several minutes. In Al-Kali, that probably meant you were dead. He, Kanina, and the luggage were alone in a long, shady alley. He could hear the bustle of the city some way away, but immediately around them there was nothing except a rather expectant silence. "They've run off," said Kanina. "Are we going to be attacked?" "Could be. There's been three men following us on the rooftops." Rincewind squinted upwards at almost the same time as three men dressed in flowing black robes dropped lightly into the alleyway in front of them. When he looked around, two more appeared from around a corner. All five were holding long, curved swords, and although the lower halves of their faces were masked, it was almost certain that they were grinning evilly. Rincewind rapped sharply on the luggage's lid. "Kill?" he suggested. The luggage stood stock still for a moment and then plodded over and stood next to Kanina. It looked slightly smug, and Rincewind realized with jealous horror, rather embarrassed. "Why, you," he growled and gave it a kick, "you handbag." He sidled closer to the girl, who was standing there with a thoughtful smile on her face. "What now?" he said. "Are you going to offer them all a quick perm?" The men edged a little closer. They were, he noticed, only interested in Kanina. "I'm not armed," she said. "What happened to your legendary comb?" "Left it on the boat." "You've got nothing?" Kanina shifted slightly to keep as many of the men as possible in her field of vision. "I've got a couple of air grips," she said out of the corner of her mouth. "Any good?" "Don't know. Never tried." "You got us into this." "Relax. I think they'll just take us prisoner." "Oh, that's fine for you to say. You're not marked down as this week's special offer." The luggage snapped its lid once or twice, a little uncertain about things. One of the men gingerly extended his sword and prodded Rincewind in the small of the back. "They want to take us somewhere, see?" said Kanina. She gritted her teeth. "Oh, no," she muttered. "What's the matter now?" "I can't do it."
"What?"
Kanina put her head in her hands. "I can't let myself be taken prisoner without a fight. I can feel 1,000 barbarian ancestors accusing me of betrayal," she hissed urgently. "Pull the other one."
"No, really. This won't take a minute."
There was a sudden blur, and the nearest man collapsed in a small gurgling heap. Then Kanina's elbows went back and into the stomachs of the men behind her. Her left hand rebounded past Rincewind's ear with a noise like tearing silk, and felled the man behind him. The fifth man made a run for it and was brought down by a flying tackle, hitting his head heavily on the wall. Kanina rolled off him and sat up, panting, her eyes bright.
"Oh, I don't like to say this, but I feel better for that," she said. "It's terrible to know that I betrayed a fine hairdressing tradition, of course."
"Oh." "Yes," said Rincewind somberly. "I wondered if you'd noticed them." Kanina's eyes scanned the line of bowmen who had appeared along the opposite wall. They had that stolid, impassive look of people who have been paid to do a job and don't much mind if the job involves killing people.
"Time for those hair grips," said Rincewind.
Kanina didn't move. My father always said that it was pointless to undertake a direct attack against an enemy extensively armed with efficient projectile weapons, she said.
Rincewind, who knew Cohen's normal method of speech, gave her a look of disbelief.
Well, what he actually said, she added, was never enter an arse-kicking contest with a porcupine.
Spelter couldn't face breakfast. He wondered whether he ought to talk to Carding, but he had a chilly feeling that the old wizard wouldn't listen and wouldn't believe him anyway. In fact, he wasn't quite sure he believed it himself. Yes, he was. He'd never forget it, although he intended to make every effort. One of the problems about living in the university these days was that the building you went to sleep in probably wasn't the same building when you woke up. Rooms had a habit of changing and moving around, a consequence of all this random magic. It built up in the carpets, charging up the wizards to such an extent that shaking hands with somebody was a surefire way of turning them into something. The build-up of magic, in fact, was overflowing the capacity of the area to hold it. If something wasn't done about it soon, then even the common people would be able to use it. A chilling thought. But since Spelter's mind was already so full of chilling thoughts you could use it as an ice tray, not one he was going to spend much time worrying about. Mere household geography wasn't the only difficulty, though. Sheer pressure of thaumaturgical inflow was even affecting the food. What was a forkful of kedgeree when you lifted it off the plate might well have turned into something else by the time it entered your mouth. If you were lucky, it was inedible. If you were unlucky, it was edible, but probably not something you liked to think that you were about to eat, or worse, had already eaten half of. Spelter found coin in what had been late last night a broom cupboard. It was a lot bigger now. It was only because Spelter had never heard of aircraft hangars that he didn't know what to compare it with, although, to be fair, very few aircraft hangars have marble floors and a lot of statuary around the place. A couple of brooms and a small battered bucket in one corner looked distinctly out of place, but not as out of place as the crushed tables in the former great hall, which, owing to the surging tides of magic now flowing through the place, had shrunk to the approximate size of what Spelter, if he had ever seen one, would have called a small telephone box. He sidled into the room with extreme caution and took his place among the council of wizards. The air was greasy with the feel of power. Spelter created a chair beside Carding and leant across to him.
"You'll never believe..."
he began.
"Quiet," hissed Carding. "This is amazing."
Coin was sitting on his stool in the middle of the circle, one hand on his staff, the other extended and holding something small, white and egg-like. It was strangely fuzzy. In fact, Spelter thought, it wasn't something small seen close to. It was something huge, but a long way off. And the boy was holding it in his hand.
"What's he doing?"
Spelter whispered.
"I'm not exactly sure," murmured Carding. "As far as we can understand, he's creating a new home for wizardry."
Streamers of coloured light flashed about the indistinct ovoid like a distant thunderstorm. The glow lit Coin's preoccupied face from below, giving it the semblance of a mask.
"I don't see how we will all fit in," the bursar said. "Carding, last night I saw..."
"It is finished," said Coin. He held up the egg, which flashed occasionally from some inner light, and gave off tiny white prominences. Not only was it a long way off, Spelter thought, it was also extremely heavy. It went right through heaviness and out the other side, into that strange negative realm where lead would be a vacuum. He grabbed Carding's sleeve again.
"Carding, listen, it's important. Listen, when I looked in..."
"I really wish you'd stop doing that."
"But the staff... his staff... it's not..."
Coin stood up and pointed the staff at the wall, where a doorway instantly appeared. He marched out through it, leaving the wizards to follow him. He went through the Arch-Chancellor's garden, followed by a gaggle of wizards in the same way that a comet is followed by its tail, and didn't stop until he reached the banks of the Ankh. There were some hoary old willows here, and the river flowed, or at any rate moved, in a horseshoe bend around a small newt-haunted meadow, known rather optimistically as Wizard's Pleasance. On summer evenings, if the wind was blowing towards the river, it was a nice area for an afternoon stroll. The warm silver haze still hung over the city as Coin padded through the damp grass until he reached the centre. He tossed the egg, which drifted in a gentle arc, and landed with a squelch. He turned to the wizards as they hurried up. "Stand well back," he commanded, "and be prepared to run." He pointed the octoron staff at the half-sunken thing. A bolt of octarine light shot from its tip and struck the egg,
exploding in a shower of sparks that left blue and purple afterimages. There was a pause. A dozen wizards watched the egg expectantly. A breeze shook the willow trees in a totally unmysterious way. Nothing else happened. Spelter began. And then came the first tremor. A few leaves fell out of the trees, and some distant water bird took off in fright. The sound started as a low groaning, experienced rather than heard, as though everyone's feet had suddenly become their ears. The trees trembled, and so did one or two wizards. The mud around the egg began to bubble and exploded. The ground peeled back like lemon rind. Gouts of steaming mud spattered the wizards as they dived for the cover of the trees. Only Coin, Spelter and Carding were left to watch the sparkling white building arise from the meadow, grass and dirt pouring off it. Other towers erupted from the ground behind them. Buttresses grew through the air, linking tower with tower. Spelter whimpered when the soil flowed away from around his feet and was replaced by flagstones flecked with silver. He lurched as the floor rose inexorably, carrying the three high above the treetops. The rooftops of the university went past and fell away below them. Ankh-Morpork spread out like a map. The river a trapped snake, the plains a misty blur. Spelter's ears popped, but the climb went on into the clouds. They emerged, drenched and cold, into blistering sunlight, with the cloud cover spreading away in every direction. Other towers were rising around them, glinting painfully in the sharpness of the day. Carding knelt down awkwardly and felt the floor gingerly. He signalled to Spelter to do the same. Spelter touched a surface that was smoother than stone. It felt like ice would feel if ice was slightly warm, and looked like ivory. While it wasn't exactly transparent, it gave the impression that it would like to be. He got the distinct feeling that, if he closed his eyes, he wouldn't be able to feel it at all. He met Carding's gaze.
"Don't look at me," he said. "I don't know what it is either."
They looked up at Coin, who said,
"It's magic."
"Yes, Lord, but what is it made of?" said Carding.
"It is made of magic. Raw magic, solidified, curdled. Renewed from second to second. Could you imagine a better substance to build the new home of sorcery?"
The staff flared for a moment, melting the clouds. The disk world appeared below them, and from up here you could see that it was indeed a disk. Pinned to the sky by the central mountain of Cori Celesti, where the gods lived. There was the Circle Sea, so close that it might even be possible to dive into it from here. There was the vast continent of Klatch, squashed by perspective. The rimfall around the edge of the world was a sparkling curve.
"It's too big,"
said Spelter under his breath. The world he had lived in hadn't stretched much further than the gates of the university, and he'd preferred it that way. A man could be comfortable in a world that size. He certainly couldn't be comfortable about being half a mile in the air standing on something that wasn't in some fundamental way there. The thought shocked him. He was a wizard, and he was worrying about magic. He sidled cautiously back towards Carding, who said,
"It isn't exactly what I expected."
"Hmm?
It looks a lot smaller from up here, doesn't it?"
"Well, I don't know. Listen, I must tell you.
Look at the ram tops now. You could almost reach out and touch them."
They stared out across 200 leagues towards the towering mountain range, glittering and white and cold. It was said that if you travelled hubwards through the secret valleys of the Ramtops, you would find in the frozen lands under Cori Celesti itself the secret realm of the ice giants, imprisoned after their last great battle with the gods. In those days the mountains had been mere islands in a great sea of ice, and ice lived on them still. Coin smiled his golden smile.
"What did you say, Carding?"
"It's the clear air, Lord, and they look so close and small. I only said I could almost touch them."
Coin waved him into silence. He extended one thin arm, rolling back his sleeve in the traditional sign that magic was about to be performed without trickery. He reached out and then turned back with his fingers closed around what was, without any shadow of a doubt, a handful of snow. The two wizards observed it in stunned silence as it melted and dripped onto the floor. Coin laughed.
"You find it so hard to believe?"
he said. "Shall I pick pearls from Rimmost Krull, or sand from the Great Neff? Could your old wizardry do half as much?" It seemed to Spelter that his voice took on a metallic edge. He stared intently at their faces. Finally, Carding sighed and said rather quietly, "No. All my life I have sought magic, and all I found was coloured lights and little tricks and old dry books. Wizardry has done nothing for the world." "And if I tell you that I intend to dissolve the orders and close the university, although, of course, my senior advisers will be accorded all due status?" Carding's knuckles whitened, but he shrugged.
"There is little to say," he said. "What good is a candle at noonday?"
Coyne turned to Spelter. So did the staff. The filigree carvings were regarding him coldly. One of them, near the top of the staff, looked unpleasantly like an eyebrow. "You are very quiet, Spelter. Do you not agree?"
"No.
The world had sorcery once and gave it up for wizardry. Wizardry is magic for men, not gods. It's not for us. There was something wrong with it, and we have forgotten what it was. I liked wizardry. It didn't upset the world. It fitted. It was right. A wizard was all I wanted to be." He looked down at his feet.
"Yes," he whispered.
"Good," said Coyne, in a satisfied tone of voice. He strolled to the edge of the tower and looked down at the street map of Ankh Morpork far below. The Tower of Art came barely a tenth of the way up towards them. "I believe," he said, "I believe that we will hold the ceremony next week at full moon."
It won't be full moon for 3 weeks," said Carding.
"Next week," Coyne repeated. "If I say the moon will be full, there will be no argument." He continued to stare down at the model buildings of the university and then pointed. "What's that?" Carding craned.
The library. Yes, it's the library."
The silence was so oppressive that Carding felt something more was expected of him. Anything would be better than that silence.
"It's where we keep the books. You know, 90,000 volumes, isn't it, Spelter?"
Yes. About 90,000, I suppose." Coyne leaned on the staff and stared. "Burn them," he said. "All of them." Midnight strutted its black stuff along the corridors of Unseen University as Spelter, with rather less confidence, crept cautiously towards the impassive doors of the library. He knocked, and the sound echoed so loudly in the empty building that he had to lean against the wall and wait for his heart to slow down a bit. After a while, he heard a sound like heavy furniture being moved about.
"Ook?"
"It's me."
"Ook?"
"Spelter."
"Ook?"
"Look, you've got to get out. He's going to burn the library."
There was no reply. Spelter let himself sag to his knees.
"He'll do it too," he whispered. "He'll probably make me do it. It's that staff. It knows everything that's going on. It knows that I know about it. Please help me."
"Ook?"
"The other night, I looked into his room. The staff was glowing. It was standing there in the middle of the room like a beacon. And the boy was on the bed, sobbing. I could feel it reaching out, teaching him, whispering terrible things. And then it noticed me. You've got to help me. You're the only one who isn't under the
Spelter stopped. His face froze. He turned around very slowly, without willing it, because something was gently spinning him. He knew the university was empty. The wizards had all moved into the new tower, where the lowliest student had a suite more splendid than any senior mage had had before. The staff hung in the air a few feet away. It was surrounded by a faint octarine glow. He stood up very carefully and, keeping his back to the stonework and his eyes firmly fixed on the thing, slithered gingerly along the wall until he reached the end of the corridor. At the corner he noted that the staff, while not moving, had revolved on its axis to follow him. He gave a little cry, grasped the skirts of his robe, and ran. The staff was in front of him. He slid to a halt and stood there, catching his breath.
"You don't frighten me,"
he lied, and turned on his heel and marched off in a different direction, snapping his fingers to produce a torch that burned with a fine white flame. Only its penumbra of octarine proclaimed it to be of magical origin. Once again the staff was in front of him. The light of his torch was sucked into a thin, singing stream of white fire that flared and vanished with a pop. He waited, his eyes watering with blue after-images. But if the staff was still there, it didn't seem to be inclined to take advantage of him.
When vision returned, he felt he could make out an even darker shadow on his left. The stairway down to the kitchens. He darted for it, leaping down the unseen steps and landing heavily and unexpectedly on uneven flags. A little moonlight flittered through a grating in the distance, and somewhere up there, he knew, was a doorway into the outside world. Staggering a little, his ankles aching, the noise of his own breath booming in his ears as though he'd stuck his entire head in a seashell, Spelter set off across the endless dark desert of the floor. Things clanked underfoot. There were no rats here now, of course, but the kitchen had fallen into disuse lately. The university's cooks had been the best in the world, but now any wizard could conjure up meals beyond mere culinary skill. The big copper pans hung neglected on the walls, their sheen already tarnishing, and the kitchen ranges under the giant chimney arch were filled with nothing but chilly ash. The staff lay across the back door like a bar. It spun up as Spelter tottered towards it and hung radiating quiet malevolence a few feet away. Then, quite smoothly, it began to glide towards him. He backed away, his feet slipping on the greasy stones. A thump across the back of his thighs made him yelp, but as he reached behind him he found it was only one of the chopping blocks. His hand groped desperately across its scarred surface, and against all hope found a cleaver buried in the wood. In an instinctive gesture as ancient as mankind, Spelter's fingers closed around its handles. He was out of breath and out of patience, and out of space and time, and also scared, very nearly, out of his mind. So when the staff hovered in front of him, he wrenched the chopper up and around with all the strength he could muster, and hesitated. All that was wizardly in him cried out against the destruction of so much power, power that perhaps even now could be used. Used by him. And the staff swung around so that its axis was pointing directly at him. And several corridors away, the librarian stood, braced with his back against the library door, watching the blue and white flashes that flickered across the floor. He heard the distant snap of raw energy, and a sound that started low and ended up in zones of pitch that even Waffles, lying with his paws over his head, could not hear. And then there was a faint, ordinary, tinkling noise, such as might be made by a fused and twisted metal cleaver dropping onto flagstones. It was the sort of noise that makes the silence that comes after it roll forward like a warm avalanche. The librarian wrapped the silence around him like a cloak, and stood staring up at the rank on rank of books, each one pulsing faintly in the glow of its own magic. Shelf after shelf looked down at him. Or up, obliquely. The layout of the Library of Unseen University was a topographical nightmare, the sheer presence of so much stored magic, twisting dimensions and gravity into the kind of spaghetti that would make M.C. Escher go for a good lie-down, or possibly sideways. They had heard. He could feel the fear. The orangutan stood statue still for several minutes, and then appeared to reach a decision. He knuckled his way across to his desk, and after much rummaging produced a heavy key ring bristling with keys. Then he went back and stood in the middle of the floor and said very deliberately, "Oog." The books craned forward on their shelves. Now he had their full attention.